Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the way that 270 million Arabs learn and converse is hobbled. That's the finding of today's Arab Human Development Report. The report, written by Arabs for Arabs, urges deep change from within. But the United States is intervening to create a new model for Arab reform in Iraq. Tonight on Point, can the Iraqi effort spark an Arab renaissance? We begin in Amman, Jordan, where the United Nations Development Program rolled out its second annual report on Arab human development today, a report written by Arab academics, intellectuals, and civic leaders for an Arab audience. Last year's initial report turned heads around the world with its frank self-assessment of political and social failings in the Arab world. I spoke with Clovis Maksoud, who contributed to the new report. I asked Professor Maksoud why the group chose to focus on an Arab knowledge deficit in this year's report.
In last year's report, we had three deficits which were more or less considered to be the principal impediments to human development throughout the Arab nation and the Arab peoples. And that is why we decided the second report would start in analyzing and focusing on one of the deficits, but we are also sensitive to the fact that every deficit is related to the other. But the focus this time was on knowledge. Because of the educational system, because the educational system affects the formative period of the young generation as students in the primary, secondary, and ultimately university levels, and that there has been an increase in the number of students and the number of teachers, but it has not been matched by an increase in the quality.
One of the issues is simply getting the information flow from around the world translated into Arabic and available. But I wonder if we could come at this from a very basic level first. What are, Clovis Maksoud, some of the indicators that your study found of a knowledge deficit in Arab societies today?
Some of the indicators is that there has been a production of graduates without being equipped in the standards that are at least the minimum that is applicable to the more evolved society, more developed societies. And in order that the students can also have job opportunities and that they should gear themselves to the priority requirements for development and for the enhancement of the quality of life throughout the Arab world.
Some numbers jump out at us here, that less than 2% of the Arab world has access to the Internet. The numbers of books published of a non-religious nature, of any nature, very small, and of a non-religious nature, extremely small. The number of books translated from around the world, very small. What are the consequences of this kind of information stranglehold?
The consequences is that, on the one hand, there is a necessity to give access on the Internet to as large a number of people as possible. There must be investment in knowledge culture, financial knowledge, and quality knowledge. And we must also have the Arab states begin serious translation of new scientific books into Arabic. And there is a need for creativity in the literary as well as in the scientific books by Arabs, and that requires also a climate of freedom in order that scientific and other research are undertaken on the level instead of being more or less dependent. And in order to have those who have succeeded in research be plugged into the educational system here instead of the brain drain that might incur as a result of lack of freedoms.
There's some note here that maybe 25% of undergraduates or graduate degree holders in the Arab world, that is BA, BS holders, emigrate, leave the Arab world.
That is because the job opportunities are not there, because of also sometimes the lack of freedom in certain areas. And therefore, they need to have more job opportunities and more research capabilities. And in that sense, that is what I call the brain drain that has characterized many in the developing countries, and it has become serious in the Arab world.
last year when the first report came out, the Arab world was described by the Arab intellectuals who put this report together as being at a crossroads. The world is globalizing quickly, and this region was being left behind. A year on, Clavis Maksoud, are you optimistic that progress is being made, or is the Arab world still moving more into the camp of religious fundamentalists rather than those who would have it catch up with the globalizing world?
I think that progress has been made in the terms of being more enlightened. But on the other hand, progress has been arrested partly by the invasion of Iraq and partly by the continuous bleeding process that is taking place among the Palestinians as a result of Israeli occupation. So in a way, there is more awareness of a national consciousness about the Arabs, and this is one of the major contributions that the two reports have been doing, and that is a consciousness of the Arab identity, that the Arab identity should be pluralistic, it should be democratic, it should empower women. And so that awareness has been enhanced as a result of the first report. But on the other hand, the impediments towards translating this enlightenment into policies and realities has been obstructed by the continuous humiliation of the Palestinian people by the occupation and the fact that there is no map at the end of the roadmap, which is clear, so that at least that might be a diffusing element in the crisis that is taking place in Palestine, and that there hasn't been a clarity of the outcome about Iraq. And although there is a realization that in Iraq the violent aspects is a matter of vengeance and not of resistance, yet resistance is a potential if the coalition in Iraq maintains the fact that not being clear about expediting the process of freedom and liberation in Iraq.
Sounds like a lot of obstructions out there with a very big project. Clavis Maksoud, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Clavis Maksoud, a professor at the American University in Washington, helped author the latest Arab Human Development Report. He spoke with me from Amman, Jordan. So, the United Nations Development Program published a report today calling on Arab states to combat a growing knowledge deficit. This paper, the second in a series, observes that reformers committed to the free exchange of ideas face deep-seated obstacles in the Arab world, and its authors, Arabs themselves, suggest sweeping changes from within. But meanwhile, in Iraq, the United States is working to refashion an entire Arab country with troops from Buffalo, Biloxi, and San Jose as change agents. This new Iraq, T. Washington Powers hope, will be a catalyst to change throughout the Arab world. So how do the reform urges from within and the urges from without line up? Can Iraq lead the Arab world to a new status quo that Arabs themselves are saying they need? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Fawaz Jerjes, Professor of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. He's spent the past several months traveling all over the Middle East, researching the effects of American foreign policy in the region. He just returned on Saturday. His forthcoming book is The Islamists and the West, Ideology versus Pragmatism. Good evening and welcome, Fawaz Jerjes.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Fawaz.
Hello.
So, Fawaz Jerjes, here we are, a new report from Arabs on Arab human development, as they frame it, points out a great big knowledge deficit and all kinds of roots for that, but is fundamentally optimistic in the sense that they say Arab culture can support knowledge and has historically. You're just back. Is it as bad a situation as this report paints?
The situation is highly volatile and highly complex, and I think the report legitimately and correctly recognizes, as you said, a growing knowledge gap between the Arab world and the rest of humanity. Let's just give our readers a kind of, you might say, a glimpse of what the report talks about. For example, there are just 18 computers per 1,000 people in the Arab region compared with almost 79 per 1,000 globally. And as you said, less than 2% of the Arab population has access to internet. there is a huge, and this is a very important point, and I think Lofis mentioned it, there's a huge brain drain taking place in the Arab world today. Large percentages of educated people are immigrating and leaving a scientific and cultural void in their wake. In fact, I would argue that the Arab world is being depopulated from its educational, educated and skilled class. And this has serious ramifications for socio-political and economic development. Although the Arab region, as you said, represents about 5% of the world population, it produces almost 1% of the books in the world. In fact, there are more books being translated in one country, that's Spain, than the entire Arab world, that is 22 states. There are less than 53 newspapers per 1,000 Arab citizens, compared to almost 300 per 1,000 people in the developed country. We can go on and on and on. The combined GDP of the 22 Arab states was less than one single European country, that is Spain. So the situation is highly difficult, highly challenging, very volatile. And here you have, on top of that, on top of the socioeconomic and political decline, you have major political crisis in Palestine, in Iraq, in Algeria. So you couple the internal socio-political and economic situation with the political and political crisis, and you have a major, major situation on your hands.
The academics and intellectuals who put together this report with the UN that came out today are saying, let's solve this from within. And we're going to look at that tonight, but we want to understand the dance between that impulse and the impulse from Washington, which is on display in Iraq right now, which is to some extent to impose or spark a kind of reform there with intervention from without that they hope will then roll across the region. We've heard that vision. Is that realistic?
If there is one big point that the report makes today, is that it makes it very clear that change must come from within. It must evolve from within gradually and peacefully. In the end, I think the report and the Arab scholars, women and men, who basically contributed to the report, made it very clear that only Arabs with international assistance can succeed in transforming their societies. No external country, no external power, regardless of how powerful, can do so for Arabs and Muslims. And I think the other point that the report makes is that military and political shocks will not do the trick.
But if that's true, Fawaz Yurjiz, why has it taken so long? I mean, the appearance, looking at the Middle East, is that it has not changed. In fact, that it's, as you describe yourself and the report describes, it's there's been backsliding there. There's been loss of progress. Why not? At some point, is it perhaps valuable for somebody to come in and help break a logjam?
Let me just add one particular point, and I'll answer your question, because your question is highly critical here. I mean, the report makes it very clear that political and military shocks could produce backlash and further delay the process of liberalization. Given that in the minds of many Arabs, democracy is closely associated with European colonialism. I think the report tries to answer your question, is that there is a particular alliance between authoritarian governments, which basically exist in every country, and you might say reactionary forces, in particular the religious establishment. This particular unholy alliance between the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East and the reactionary religious establishment has stifled the potential for liberalization and change in the Arab world. And I cannot help but add one particular point, is that the United States itself, in the last 50 years, made it very clear that democracy and liberalism were not very high on its agenda. In fact, the United States played a decisive role in maintaining the status quo that, in fact, brought us to 9/11, unfortunately.
But Jack Beatty, the U.S. is saying something very different today, and it's voting with its feet in a way. The troops are in Iraq, and no small part of the rationale has been we must instigate change in this region. It's stuck. It's an awful kind of posture to the world.
Yes, you've even heard people. I heard people in Washington saying we have to shake things up. But, of course, when you shake them up, you don't know how they're going to be when they land. And, of course, it's human beings and subtle ways of life and belief that are being shaken up. That vision of the wave of democracy, the State Department itself said, no tsunami, no wave, not likely. Well, even the Bush State Department didn't think it was likely.
But there are troops there right now, and that's part of the reason we're looking at post-Saddam Iraq as a spark for reform in the Arab world, and whether or not it can work, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at post-Saddam Iraq as a spark for reform in the Arab world and whether or not it will work, whether reform can be imposed from the outside, imported from the outside. A big report out today from Arab academics, Arab intellectuals, saying we have a terrible knowledge gap among the 270 million Arabs in 22 Arab countries across that region. And we have social structures, and we have an education system that's perpetuating this. We can't live with it. We need reform from within. Washington is pushing reform in part from without, at least in the hope of sparking it from within. Will that work? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with Fawaz Jurjez. He's professor of international affairs and Middle Eastern studies at Sarah Lawrence College. We're joined now from Chicago by Gidi Nashat. She's associate professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago, a fellow at the Hoover Institute, author of The Origins of Modern Reform in Iran. Good evening and welcome, Gidi Nashat.
Good evening. Thank you for asking me to be on your program.
It's wonderful to have you. We're looking at this big report out today and trying to figure out how it fits into the picture alongside the effort underway in Iraq. Both from Washington and from the academics and intellectuals who have offered the report today is this cry, we want reform, we need reform. What's your sense? Can Iraq contribute to this effort? Is it a distraction, a detraction? Can the Arabs really produce this reform themselves? We haven't seen it yet.
Well, let me say that I have great respect for Professor Maqsood and Professor Jurjez. However, I do differ with their analysis of what's wrong with the Arab world. To begin with, the Iraqis, being half Iraqi myself, most Iraqis are very happy that they are rid of the dictatorial, repressive regime of Saddam Hussein, and they're very unhappy that none of their Arab brothers and intellectuals ever criticized Saddam Hussein, who for 30 years oppressed them. This is number one. Number two, I do believe that Iraqis should be given the chance to try to develop their own version of democracy. I don't believe we can impose democracy from outside on any given country. We know, we have seen the example of what happened in Haiti. We know that India was a democracy, and yet it was a poor and backward country. What made the difference in India and in China, two poor countries that until about a decade ago followed status policies, and they had dictatorial regime, or one was a democracy, one was an authoritarian regime, was that they abandoned their status policies. And this is one of the things that made me sad on reading this long report that my fellow Arab intellectuals have put together, that they haven't really put their finger at what will make the big difference. How can you really develop human capital of a country? You can only develop it if you have economic competition and political competition, two factors that do not exist in the Arab world.
But we have here Rima Khalaf Hunaidi, who was the director of the study, and she says they've got gaps there, missing links, smothered by ideologies, societal structures, and values that inhibit critical thinking. That sounds like a critique of certainly recent policies, and those recent policies are already statist.
No, well, absolutely. I think the Arab countries, since the 1950s, since their independence, first they became outright socialist or Arab. They had a combination of Arab nationalism and socialism. And then in the 70s and 80s, especially the Arab intellectuals, they became fascinated by the idea of dependency theory. So to them, any involvement with the world economy, with the global economy, was something that smacked of imperialism, colonialism. But when we look at India, in fact, there was, I would like to recommend to all your listeners an article in the New York Times today about India and how India has suddenly has begun to bloom. And we know the same thing has happened in China.
Booming economically after they opened up to the world.
Economically, and it's acquiring a middle class, because in order to have a democracy that will survive and will be protected, you need a large middle class.
But you know, the idea of at least some portion of Washington power brokers is that that's exactly the kind of opening that this intervention in Iraq can provoke, can engineer.
Well, the thing about Iraq is that it already has a sizable, very educated middle class. Iraq is the most advanced in terms of education of all the Arab countries, and therefore I don't think we need to create this kind of class. Furthermore, it has a very large urban population. Despite the appearance of discord about between the various sectarian and ethnic groups, Iraq, in my view, is probably the most capable country of attaining a more democratic system. It will not be an American-style democracy, the way our democracy differs from European-type democracy.
Fawaz, join us here. You're just back from the region. We're looking for the way forward here.
I think it's truly very misleading. I mean, for a person like me who travels a great deal in the region, who resides in the region for long periods of time, I think what we need to remember is that the first two reports are not the only reports that have come out of the Arab world. There's a great deal of debate taking place in the Arab world and in Iran as well and in Turkey as well. I think what we need to understand, there is a cultural war taking place between enlightened liberal forces and reactionary forces that have maintained their grip on the Arab world. So I think the fact that we pay a great deal of attention to these reports, because they are written in English and they are sponsored by the United Nations, and in fact many critics in the Arab world argue that Western critics have used and abused these reports in order to score political points. But the point... Hello?
Yes, we're here.
But I think what I'm trying to say here is that there are many voices in the Arab world who challenge the absolutism and fanaticism of extremism and also of authoritarianism. Let's remember that thousands of, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of courageous Iraqis and Arabs have paid with their lives for standing up to militant extremism and Islamism and authoritarianism, including Saddam Hussein itself.
But Fawaz, are you willing to concede in any way that the U.S. presence in Iraq now might help get the Arab region off the dime, might help break loose reform efforts? After all, at least a tyrant is out of the way. Isn't that helpful? Can the U.S. actively helpful there?
Absolutely. And here I want to say, since I've just come from the Middle East, many people in Iraq, the Arab world and the Muslim world, are closely observing to see if the United States practices what it preaches about democracy in the world. Even though many people remain skeptical in light of the uncertainties and reluctance of the U.S. administration to hand power over to Iraqis and hold elections, of course, take risks on people's choices, I think what happens in Iraq is truly very critical, because on the one hand, the flourishing of democracy in Baghdad, in Iraq, will likely disinvest Arabs from their historical grievances against the West, and failure in Iraq will reinforce widely held perceptions that democracy is but a tool designed by Washington to perpetuate Western hegemony over the vast portion of the Muslim world that belongs to the Arabs. And I think this is why what happens in Iraq is highly critical, not only to the future of Iraq and Iraqis, but also to America's credibility and status in the rest of the Arab and Muslim world.
Jack Beattie, I hear Fawaz Jirjaz saying there that if it can work, if some kind of democracy can be planted here, that it can be a spark, a model in some degree.
Yes, and importantly, I expressed earlier the skepticism that the State Department had about it. They said no falling dominoes, and they instanced, as I remember that report, resistance that was both religious and cultural, and in Iraq, ethnic, that there were just all these various ethnic groups and religious groups, and that it was just although this was promising for the middle class and the other things the professor was talking about, it was unpromising because of its tendency toward its factionalism, that this was a tough polity to make a model democracy. You can make some kind of federation, perhaps, out of it.
And yet Gidi Nishat is saying here, look at Iraq's history. There's reason to think that it could work here at the same
not
time.
Not only that. I mean, you can look at a country like Switzerland. Switzerland is made up of different religious and ethnic groups. They're Catholics, Protestants, in fact, Luther or Calvin started in Geneva. So, and then southern Switzerland has a lot of Catholics. And they're Italians, Germans, and French. And yet they have managed to live together. The point is, once a country reaches the point when it realizes that they need to come together instead of fight each other, that will be to everybody's benefit, they will do that. And I think Iraq has a large enough group of people, intellectuals, Sunni, Shiites, Kurds, who are aware of this, and they do not want to have another dictatorship imposed on them.
But we hear Fawaz Yirji saying there, Iraq is not Switzerland. I'm sure many people would nod at that. Let's invite our callers in. David's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have 2 points. First of all, I am an Arab. I came from Kuwait. I'm a Lebanese citizen, but I live in Kuwait.
Got it.
First of all, the people in the Gulf, the government of the Gulf, they prefer to have American citizen or a European citizen to work on their country instead over the Arab people, even if they are the same in the same level.
To work in what capacity, David? You mean in business?
To be a scientist, to take a job, you know, for engineering.
Why would that be? Why wouldn't they want Arabs to rise to the top of their own countries?
Because they're afraid. Because they're afraid the Arab, when they become popular in the country, that become, you know, they become, you know, threat to their throne, and they don't want that. Because if they bring American, the American comes, work, and goes home. And
so you're saying there's an active preference for foreign talent there, foreign knowledge. And your other point?
The other point is, if United States is going to make democracy in Iraq, but the democracy they are looking for, it's for their benefit, for United States benefit. If this democracy is going to work against United States benefit, United States is not going to allow that to happen. And United States is not interested to make the Arab self-sufficient, because who's going to buy their products? I mean, a simple mathematical calculation. I mean, that's all.
Except there seems to be a new impulse now. David, thanks for your call. Fawaz Yirji, please.
Make a clear distinction between rhetoric and reality. I think the rhetoric in Washington is very refreshing indeed. And I truly believe about democracy, as you know, because for the last 50 years, between 1948, the emergence of the United States as a global power in the struggle against communism, I think democracy and liberalism were not, as I said, vital principles on its agenda. But now it seems to me there is a particular dramatic shift in the rhetoric in Washington. And let's hope, let's hope that the United States practices what it preaches about democracy and reforms and human rights and the transparency of rule of law, because many people in the Arab world and the Muslim world, and legitimately so, remain skeptical about America's genuine commitment to basically keeping a distance from its authoritarian allies in the region. Let's talk about recent events. When President Bush visited the Middle East in June, President Bush and his senior aides spent most of their meeting in June with the leaders of Bahrain, Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, pressing them to fight terrorism. Not even a single word, not even a single statement about the need to reform their societies, about the need to promote democracy, about the need to respect human rights.
But we've just heard word of elections coming, local elections in Saudi Arabia. I'm reading a Reuters report today that textbooks are going to be purged of a whole chapter that's very opposed to Christians and Jews and in interaction with so-called infidels.
And this brings us to, when we talk about democracy, we're talking about a long-term process. This is why shocks won't do, because it has to come from within with pressure from the United States and the international community. No one is suggesting that the international community, particularly the United States, cannot serve as catalyst for good. But it's essential that the United States practices what it preaches. It cannot just, and let's be, again, come back to the institutional debate in the United States itself about democracy has not been resolved yet.
The institutional debate, meaning Washington is not sure it really supports democracy?
There's a great deal of debate in the U.S. foreign policy establishment, whether to fight terrorism or whether to exert pressure on Middle Eastern allies to open up the political space. Let's remember here what we need to understand. If you open the political space in almost every Middle Eastern country, Islamists will tend to predominate in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in every country.
In Iraq?
This is why the debate itself in Washington has not been resolved. And this is why it seems to me, given a choice between fighting terrorism and promoting democracy, it seems to me the consensus in the United States itself and the Middle East is that the United States will choose to fight democracy and to exert pressure
to fight terrorism. Gideon Nishat, what do you make of that? Did you agree that a democracy in Iraq will mean an Islamist government there, for example?
There are several points. I think I wanted to answer one of the points that one of your listeners made
mm-hmm.
about
mm-hmm.
why that in the Emirates they prefer to have Americans and Europeans to Arabs. Well, the point is that these countries became rich suddenly during the last 2-3 decades, and they didn't want to share their wealth with their fellow Arab, This is why, as one of your participants said, mm-hmm. the Americans leave, whereas the Palestinians would become Emirate citizens. So this was one of the reasons.
So they'd rather hire Westerners to come in and do the work,
exactly,
or non-Arabs
exactly.
in any case.
That was one of the reasons. And they didn't have themselves the human resources or the knowledge to do the work themselves. So they.
Yeah, but you're saying even when they did, they preferred to hire outside. That's a pretty big impediment to developing local talent.
Absolutely, absolutely. But because these were very small countries with very small populations with enormous wealth. So they had to rely on outside know-how in order to develop their wealth.
Well, they had to a certain point, but the whole point of the report today is that they did that even when they didn't need to, and that's our caller's point as well.
The point is that because the rhetoric among the Arabs is that we're all brothers, let's all share our wealth. To many of the Saudis, the Iraqis, and those who had Libyans, and those who had more wealth, they went along with the rhetoric, but they didn't really want to implement this idea of having to share the wealth because there would be very little left for them. But the point about democracy and America's role, let's look at Iran for a minute, a country that I've been to Egypt, I've been to Iran, and in my view, Iran seemed a lot more democratic, even though the U.S. has been opposed to Iranian foreign policy, Iranian economic, has imposed sanctions in Iran. Why? Because Iran has a much larger educated middle class, and the pressure for change in Iran, despite the fact that they had a theocratic regime 23 years ago, is much greater than any other Arab country because of this large educated middle class. I think that is what many of the Arab countries lack, and many of the educated people in the Arab world, they are so afraid and traumatized by the idea that the Islamists will come to power. It has become, and of course America shares this fear, and these authoritarian regimes utilize this
Absolutely.
To keep themselves in power, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
We've got to take a break here. Gideon Nishat, Fawaz Yurtaş, Jack Beattie, please stand by. We're talking tonight about post-Saddam Iraq as a spark for reform in the Arab world and whether or not it will work, whether reform can be imposed, can be imported from outside. Do you believe the Arab world has the stuff to change from the inside out? Will Iraq show the way for an entire region? The Arab intellectuals have just taken a hard look at their societies. What do you see when you look at those societies? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about post-Saddam Iraq as a spark for reform in the Arab world and whether or not it will work. Can the Arab world catch up fast enough to defuse fundamentalist Islam? Can you see the Arab world flowering again as a center of thought and knowledge? And will the U.S. effort in Iraq help? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Chicago, Gideon Nishat, Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago, author of The Origins of Modern Reform in Iran. And from Bronxville, New York, Fawaz Yurtaş, Professor of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College and author of the forthcoming The Islamists and the West, Ideology versus Pragmatism. Right now, Anne is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Great to have you.
I wanted to just make essentially a comment. I was listening to your discussion in my car, and it struck me as an incredibly, what's the word I want? An ironic, a real...
Take us to the heart of it, Anne. What's your point here?
It was an unsettling, ironic feeling when the lady who's called in, and I'm sorry, I don't know her name, I didn't catch her name, but she was describing that people with conservative, especially leaning towards these religious, intractable sort of views, ways of looking at things,
okay,
of what is preventing the Arab world from moving forward. And I couldn't help but be struck, as an American who is not an Arab, that my feeling was that she could have been describing our government. Because my point of view is that our government is coming from a place of an ideology of having decided that they're going to do this thing. And I believe that it comes out of the arrogance of believing that we can do something, that we are so ignorant, we don't understand, that we cannot do it.
So you're seeing kind of conservatives on both sides, and you're not optimistic.
I think that the Arab world can come out of this. I think they can blossom. I think they can do many things. But I don't think the United States has any business telling them how to do it.
Anne, thanks very much for your call. Gideon Ashot, you know that some big voices, including Tom Friedman, columnist at the New York Times, have been applauding exactly this role by the United States, saying this is exactly what the Arab world needs. Courageous Arabs are rising to this moment. Iraq can be part of this wave of change. Anne says she sees conservatives ascendant in the Middle East and maybe conservatives ascendant in Washington. Is that an impediment to this change?
Well, I think your listener needs to know a little bit more about Iraq and the various different sectarian groups within Iraq. Now, the majority of Iraqis happen to be Shiites, and many of them are educated. They also followed what happened in Iran next door. They saw that a country, a government, turned it into an authoritarian, oppressive regime in the name of Islam. And that is exactly what many, even of the conservative religious leaders in Iraq, Shiite leaders in Iraq, are trying to avoid.
Those are not the ones we're hearing from. You know, we're hearing about armed guards of mullahs there taking power.
Yes, I know. Muqtadir al-Sadr, he's a young, hot-headed Shiite cleric, but he doesn't really have any theological rank, and he hasn't had that much following. If you follow the news, when he announced he's forming an Islamic State, not too many people went to support him, including the Shiites in Karbala and Najaf. He is trying to gain some political support, but the Grand Ayatollah Sistani has come out, has even appraised the presence of Americans and liberating the Iraqis from Saddam. So I don't think most Iraqis who have lived under Saddam want another dictatorship under any name, including religious dictatorship.
You're absolutely correct. I think most Iraqis are delighted and elated to be rid of Saddam Hussein, point one. I mean, I think even Muqtada al-Sadr, she referred to this fiery young Shiite leader. But there is a second side to the story, is that many Iraqis are also suspicious of the American military presence in Iraq, and many Iraqis are questioning the shifts in American strategy in Iraq. First, we went into Iraq to bring democracy into the country and transplant Jeffersonian democracy into the heartland of the Arabian desert. And secondly, what happened? Then we became concerned about the potential for an Islamic government. We fire General Garner, we bring about Paul Bremer, and we say, well, we have to take our time. We're going to take 1 or 2 years, because if we do take risks on people's choices, well, an Islamic government might take place. What has happened? I mean,
Time. Just last week at the UN, they agreed by December there should be a timetable. By a year from now, there should be...
No timetable. This is basically a theoretical issue that the Iraqi appointed governing council must come up with a particular deadline by December, but the Iraqi governing council is already bickering, and it's going to take many months. In fact, the United States has made it very clear it was unwilling and is unwilling to set a deadline for transferring power over to Iraqis. And this is why some of us who talk to Iraqis realize, while they are elated about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They are deeply suspicious of the United States. The last report by the Defense Department that was released a few weeks ago, in fact, talks about alarming signs that now dissatisfied Iraqis who were initially disposed toward the American invasion and liberation of Iraq is now are leading the fight against the American military presence in Iraq.
I want to try and get one more call here. Alan's calling from Framingham. Hi, Alan, you're on the air.
Yeah, I want to see how, ask how the presence of oil as a major income producer in any underdeveloped countries is going to, how they're going to get over that, because the problem is that in all countries where that's the case, developing countries, oil is the aggravating factor against democracy. And, you take Venezuela, it's now in the civil war, you take Nigeria.
Yeah, we've heard again and again about the oil curse. Let us pick that up, Alan, and thanks for your call. Getting a shot, how about it? We see in the report from the UN today, from the Arab intellectuals, they're saying, it's interesting, there's been a kind of illusion that if you buy technology, it's yours. They're saying, no, you have to learn how to create it yourself to really make it yours.
Absolutely. This is something that goes back to 1800 when Muhammad Ali tried to import some fabric factories from England, from Switzerland and France to create, to turn Egypt into an industrial society. You do need an educated population that can run whatever you try to import in order to make a success of it. And the problem with the oil, however, I'd like to go back to the oil question. I think it is true that the discovery of oil and the revenue from oil has been one of the curses on the Middle East.
And yet we need this region to make exactly the kind of transformation these Arab intellectuals are talking about. What's the best way? If you could take away all other agendas, what's the best way, getting a shot for the U.S. to help?
Okay. Look at two countries that developed without having too many resources. Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. These are three countries that didn't have any major natural resources. What did they have? They had human capital. They had an educated population. And they began by educating their elementary school children and providing cheap labor to the world.
That's great to say, but how do you get the Arab world on that track?
Arab world. There is no reason why in the Arab world many of the Arab countries cannot do that. First of all, the rich countries are not going to give money to their poorer Arab brothers. This is one thing that many Arabs have not really yet accepted. They think, if they change the regime, there is going to be a redistribution.
We've just got a minute left. Fawaz Yurshi, same question to you. What should the U.S. do that would be most positive here?
Well, the U.S.
Fawaz Yurshi, please. Yes. I've just got a minute.
I think we are avoiding answering the question. Absolutely. Oil has been a curse. It has been a curse internally because it has empowered dictators throughout the Middle East and created, you might say, huge bureaucracies. And Saddam Hussein, the various leaders have been able to create huge armies and wage war, and of course, at the cost of their population. But the other side, again, there's always the other side of the story, is that it's for this particular reason, because the oil economy, the world economy, runs on cheap oil from the Middle East, the United States was reluctant to take risks on reforms and change in the Middle East. That is, oil has served both as a curse internally and also, you might say, as a pressure, or in fact, it has convinced...
Is that dynamic any different now, post 9/11? Is
yes,
it any
absolutely.
Different? Even for the U.S.?
Yes, the United States has come to realize that unless the Arab and Muslim world reform itself, unless Arabs and Muslims become freer, unless authoritarianism basically gets transformed, I think militarism and extremism will reach the American shores.
With that, we're out of time. Fawaz Yurshi, thanks so much for joining us. And Gideon Nishat in Chicago, thank you very much for being with us tonight. Jack Peedy, we're out of time, but thanks so much for being here.
All right, thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, Frank Lloyd Wright's four-decade-old vision for downtown Baghdad. This is On Point. For centuries, the Arabian Nights has conjured images of genies, jewels, silks, and sultans from the cradle of civilization. American architect Frank Lloyd Wright was captivated by the story as a child. When Wright became world famous, he remained an enthusiast for Middle Eastern culture. In 1957, Frank Lloyd Wright was commissioned by Iraq's King Faisal II to design an opera house for Baghdad. He came back with a plan for Greater Baghdad, a sweeping vision for the Iraqi capital on the Tigris. The king was killed in 1958, and Wright's death came soon after. The plans were set aside until they were recently rediscovered. Some U.S. officials are now considering Wright's designs as they rebuild Baghdad from the rubble. In this radio diary, Mina Marafat, who published the long-forgotten plans in 1999, talks about Frank Lloyd Wright's architectural vision for the city of Baghdad.
Wright created a wonderful three-tiered ziggurat parking access through this esplanade that was lined with kiosks that emulated the bazaar concept in Middle Eastern architecture. And what he proposed was a series of pavilions that would feature the handicrafts of the area and would be a viable way of generating income, especially if this was to become a tourist attraction. He was, in fact, envisioning a theme park concept long before Walt Disney had done so. It centered on this wonderful island that he convinced the king to give to him. And using this island as the main feature, he created a context for the university, for the auditorium, which doubled up as the opera house, and for this Garden of Eden, which he created. I think that if Wright's project had been built, it would have softened the callous exchange between the East and West. And I'm speaking in terms of architecture. I think what happened was, indeed, most of the architecture that was imported into the Middle East was very modern and in some ways brutalist in its style. And it was not recognizable as having anything to do with the context and the culture for which it was being designed. My idealistic view is that, in fact, major figures, star figures like that, do impact history. And if his project had been built, I think that it would have had a major role in changing the nature of the exchange so that it did not appear as imperialistic as it did to the people of other regions than the West. And this sort of antagonism that has emerged, I think, is partly because very few people had any desire to have that contextual, respectful approach. I think there are major, significant lessons that could be learnt from the Frank Lloyd Wright experience in designing for Baghdad. First, he was extremely respectful of the culture. Because it is a very rich culture. There is a tradition and a culture there that is worthy of retaining, learning about, and promoting. And Wright was very aware of that, and he was able to apply that cultural understanding into a modern piece of work that was not imitating. It was not replicating necessarily in the pejorative sense of the word, anything of the past, but rather taking the spirit of the past and using it. And I think that there is a great lesson to be learned there, to recognize that just because that culture is different doesn't mean that they are any less advanced than ours.
Mina Marafat, Rockefeller Scholar at the Library of Congress, discussing Frank Lloyd Wright's 1957 version for Baghdad. To view images of Wright's plans, visit onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Mata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.